Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We have the rare privilege of being able to speak to a man who has been really at the very center of some hugely important public policy, public health challenges in particular. He's a man whose expertise in the phenomenon of biological warfare is perhaps without peer at the moment, in the United States of America at least. He is the author of a brand new article that was peer-reviewed and published by the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons, a very distinguished outfit, and it brings some hard truths to light about what happened to us in the course of the COVID-19 debacle, as he calls it, the subject of a forthcoming book entitled Doctors versus Doctors, The War Between Doctors. Subtitle is Lies, Incompetence, Corruption in the COVID Debacle. He is also the author of 3 Seconds Until Midnight and a dear friend and colleague who helped tremendously contribute to this book by Team B3 entitled The CCP is at War with America. His name is Dr. Stephen Hatfill, and he's always a welcome guest here. Doctor, welcome back, sir. Good to have you with us.
All right, good to see you, sir.
The pleasure is mine, and I want to say, especially because it's on the occasion where I think you have been recognized by your peers as having something important to say. That hasn't always been the case, has it? Especially in your truth-telling about the COVID phenomenon and our response to it. Tell us about this article. Tell us about, what it tries to document for all of our benefit.
We go through a great deal of literature over the last 3 years and try to show how the vaccines, the early warnings intentionally missed of the dangers of these. And the fact that by the middle of 2020, in the Trump administration, it was abundantly clear that hydroxychloroquine was a safe drug and highly effective, reducing hospital mortality if we could give it to the patients within the first 7 days of symptoms. It kept 70 to 80% of them out of the hospital.
Now, you're talking about not the COVID disease. You're talking about the treatment for the disease, the so-called vaccines, gene therapies, and the dangers associated with them, which you're saying were known early on?
Absolutely. We didn't. Yes, right from the start.
Wow.
Pete Navarro and I worked together. I was his senior medical advisor at the White House.
And Peter Navarro, again, was the guy who was responsible for manufacturing and trade policy, as I recall, in the White House.
And Pete Navarro got a hold of this and down in the Situation Room and caused a huge ruckus. And within a couple weeks, we had 62 million doses of this drug in the national stockpile.
This drug was the hydroxychloroquine.
And it was being shipped out through McKinsey and Cardinal and all the pharmaceutical suppliers. And doctors were writing scripts for it successfully.
And this was right after, I guess, Donald Trump was persuaded on the basis of the evidence to say, very promising, right?
Donald Trump took it.
Yeah, among other things.
Ballet exposed him. And, nobody's going to give the president of the United States a drug that can suddenly make you fall over dead. That's not going to happen in any universe. So the drug was very safe. And then, and effective. In fact, 1 out of 20 Americans, we think, took hydroxychloroquine during the pandemic.
Hmm. And survived to tell the tale. But if I could just ask your indulgence, Dr. Hatfill, I do want to just pause for 1 second. We'll come back to that narrative. But preceding it, when you were at the White House, as a duty expert on not just the biological, you know, threats, but also on what is the appropriate response to them.
Yeah,
I'm very impressed by the fact that there was a plan in place for dealing with things like this. And what happened to that plan, sir?
This plan had a 50-year history since 1951. It had evolved. You know, we used to not have any antiviral medications till the 60s. We had amantadine for influenza. But we've gone through four major now influenza pandemics. And each time the plan would be more and more refined until finally we started having some useful drugs. With a virus like COVID-19, it is virtually impossible to vaccinate your way out of a pandemic once it's started. This is because this thing mutates twice as fast as influenza, and you know we have to have a new influenza shot every year. And if we don't guess the right strain that's going to be pandemic, it doesn't work. Most of the time, it's 40%, 50% effective. It's all a guessing game. So the way
you... So just to be clear, in the pandemic plan that was on the books, that had been there for 50 years, that had been refined over that period of time, doing a vaccine, warp speed or otherwise, was not part of the plan. Is that right?
A vaccine was always a part of the plan. Just like during the Manhattan Project, we tried three different ways to concentrate uranium and built huge factories to do this because we didn't know which one would work. So in a major pandemic, you want to try all options because speed is of the essence. If you can't contain this thing very quickly, you're in really big trouble. And COVID-19 had a less than 1% death rate. And some of these things out there have 40, 50% death rate, 60% death. So
particularly the weaponized versions of them, right?
Even the natural versions.
Yeah.
Some strains of Ebola have a 90% death rate. So Mother Nature, it's not just natural pandemics, but it's intentional biological warfare. The two share some commonalities, but they can't be mixed. They're separate responses and separate requirements.
I'm sorry, the two being what?
Pandemic.
Vaccines and non-vaccine approaches?
Response to a pandemic and the response to a biological warfare attack.
Got it. Okay. So you can have naturally occurring pandemics. You can also have these things that are engineered by man for specifically the purpose of killing people.
Yeah.
So just again, to go back and level set here, sir, in terms of the pandemic response that was essentially jettisoned, as I understand it, basically on the instigation of the World Health Organization, outfit we'll be talking more about in subsequent blocks, but that there was in the plan working on these kinds of vaccination approaches, but did lockdowns feature in the plan? Did masks and social distancing and that sort of thing?
No.
Where did that come from, sir?
These were stuck in probably around 2008, 2009, or 2010. No lockdowns, but the masking and what they call social distancing measures. By themselves, none of them work.
But all of that was precedent to this pandemic in 2019, 2020, 2021. Hold the thought, sir. We're going to come back and we're going to stitch all this together a little more clearly for my benefit and certainly for the audience's. We'll be right back with more on the other side of the short break with Dr. Stephen Hatfield. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. There's been a lot of talk lately about the big lie, the totalitarian practice of repeating an untruth until it inevitably becomes accepted by the masses as true. One monstrously big lie at the moment is Democratic partisans' insistence there's no evidence that Joe Biden has engaged in bribery and other crimes for which the constitutional remedy is impeachment. With House of Representatives Republicans yesterday unanimously agreeing to initiate a formal inquiry, the question is not whether the evidence is sufficient to warrant what amounts to an indictment by the House. Rather, it is whether treason will be among the charges. The available evidence shows that Biden has received directly and indirectly tens of millions of dollars from the Chinese Communist Party, and virtually every one of his policies has harmed our country and benefited the CCP. Let the prosecution begin. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We're visiting with Dr. Stephen Hatfill. We're trying to put together kind of the forensic analysis of what happened to us in connection with the emergence of a virus. We were told from a wet market in Wuhan, China. And we're going to talk a little bit about the actual origins and what Dr. Stephen Hatfill has helped establish is the case with all of that. But just Stephen, we've got a bit of evidence here that somewhere along the trail, in addition to not really clarity about where this thing emerged from, in fact, a biological warfare laboratory in Wuhan, not a wet market, how to respond to it most effectively. And I want you to just sort of help us make sense of what, especially from your vantage point, working with Dr. Peter Navarro in the White House at the time, was going on, and what you've put in your new article for the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons.
We have a history of pandemic planning, chiefly for influenza, because we've had four major pandemics over the last century. The worst was 1918, which killed hundreds of millions of people. The Spanish flu. And we had tried to have pandemic plans following 1957, the Hong Kong flu. A revision was made. The Epidemic Intelligence Service had already been established to detect a biological warfare attack on the United States following some open-air tests in 1951. 1957, there wasn't a vaccine ready in time. The 1960s were a period where the first rudimentary plan came together, but it was based on vaccines because we didn't have a lot of antiviral drugs. These, you know, virus isn't like an antibiotic. So for bacteria. So as we started to get more and more antiviral drugs, the concept of early outpatient treatment became viable. Mm-hmm. In 2005, President...
And these are drugs like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So by 2005, George Bush called for a revision of pandemic planning. And a very good job was done by Health and Human Services and by ASPR, which is in Bob Cadlick's bunch at the time. And this got down to what would the federal response look like, understanding that it was always the local communities that would bear the brunt of the problem, and that it's the local communities that would have to be able to handle what we call a medical surge. Suddenly, an increased use of hospital beds. Suddenly, more efficient distribution of drugs. Vaccines were always a part of it, but we've never had a vaccine on time in any pandemic. And
those antiviral drugs, which in the interval had become not only very safe, and proven, and
some of them, yes,
and they cost effective as well, were available for early treatment. Was that part of the plan?
Yes.
To at the local level.
Hospital. Mm-hmm. And it will control a pandemic, early outpatient treatment. You're sick. You come to see your doctor. There's a pandemic going on. You have all the signs and symptoms. You don't need testing if the drug is safe. You treat on suspicion. Doctors have been doing this for years. You go see your doctor for a cold. He doesn't send a test off and wait to see which one of 120 different viruses are causing your problem. It treats it empirically.
And rapidly.
Yeah.
To try to nip it in the bud.
Yeah.
And he, as your key point there was, and he does it because there's very low risk. Even if it's off label, as they say, if it's not for exactly the purpose that the thing was initially used. And how widely used have these antivirals like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin been, Doctor?
Well, we didn't know hydroxychloroquine was an antiviral till about 2005. When this was after the 2003 SARS-1 outbreak, coronavirus. And that scared everybody. And it was actually the CDC themselves that found out that a drug called chloroquine, an anti-malarial drug, you take for malaria. Millions of people have had it safely throughout the world, and they found that it blocked the coronavirus replication. So now we come to SARS-2. And the Chinese were very quick to realize this, and the South Koreans found that it was effective. They started manufacturing tons of the drug. The South Koreans found out that a related but different drug, hydroxychloroquine, was not only safer but more effective for COVID-19. And that gave us enough information to fight for that drug to be into the national stockpile.
And remind us about the timing of this, sir. This was early on, you say.
March.
March of 2020?
Yes.
Wow.
And Peter Navarro got a hold of this and had a big fight in the Situation Room with Anthony Fauci.
You mentioned the fight. It was with Tony Fauci.
Apparently there was yelling going on and papers being flung across the table. And, you know, Peter can be very forceful sometimes. And it was decided, okay, Peter, you can have your hydroxychloroquine. And within days, we had 62 million doses put into the national stockpile.
Wow.
The drugs used...
Because that's Peter's thing in that particular job. He was all about, you know, mobilizing resources, Defense Production Act and the like, right?
If you could convince him.
Yeah.
And he got his teeth stuck into it, it was going to happen.
Yeah.
Fearless.
So we had tens of millions of doses available of a... antiviral drug that works, that was safe.
Safe drug.
And somehow that didn't actually get widely applied, especially on an early treatment basis.
It started.
Yeah.
And hence the title of the new book, Lies, Incompetence, and Corruption. The big drug companies didn't like this. They were already working on these mRNA vaccines, and they stood to make profits $1 billion, which they've done.
And they'd sold the president and the administration on the idea that they could accelerate the...
Anthony Fauci had a pet drug called remdesivir, that's deadly, which turned out by the WHO own standards to actually have no effect at all. No use at all in any treatment of any phase of COVID-19. It's toxic. Ebola, you kill people with it. You send them into kidney failure. So, and he bought $1.2 billion worth of the drug before the clinical trials were even done. Dr. Anthony Fauci,
So here we have a division within the government, obviously.
Yeah.
The president came out, as we were talking about in the first block, endorsing hydroxychloroquine as something that was promising, took it himself, as you said. Survived it, needless to say.
Trying it's safe.
It is safe, indeed. So, and had it been widely used at that point, pandemic would have petered out very quickly, right?
Not just for malaria, but for rheumatoid arthritis, for lupus, for sarcoidosis, for a variety of connective tissue diseases.
Right. All right, Doctor, we're right back, I think, where we began this segment. We have to take another pause. We'll be right back with more with Dr. Stephen Hatfill and how all of this impacted your life in all likelihood, certainly the lives of hundreds of millions of Americans and countless others around the world, because we wound up taking drugs that not only didn't work, but were dangerous, and not taking the drugs that did work and were safe. More on this on the other side. Stay tuned.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Dr. Stephen Hatfill, one of the most eminent scientists in the country, certainly one of those who understands best the nasty business of biological warfare and the medical conditions that are associated with it, as well as pandemics and the natural thing scheme of things. And Doctor, you've been working through, I'm afraid I've not been as helpful a guide myself in all of this as you are, but I did want to now just take a moment, having got a little bit of our understanding of what we began to do to respond to this. In the mix, Tony Fauci, the man who was very vehemently disagreeing with the idea that there's a cheap, safe, effective, available drug that could be used, hydroxychloroquine, was also not coming forth about what he knew about the Wuhan Institute of Virology and the kind of work that it was doing with his funding and technology. Just to further sort of drill down on that piece of this, because it bears further on the question of what were some of these doctors doing that was making matters considerably worse. Talk a little bit about the origins of this disease, what he knew at the time and what he concealed from the rest of us, and why that mattered.
We had an outbreak in 2003 of SARS-1. It did occur in a meat market, a fresh food market in China. The Chinese covered it up. It spread to the human population. We had SARS-1. It went pandemic. And fortunately, it wasn't that fully adapted to man. But it was lethal.
But it was a naturally occurring disease?
Crammed some horseshoe bats together with civet cats and viral trafficking and this type of thing.
But the fact that it was naturally occurring helped explain why it did not make as efficient a link to man as might otherwise have been the case, right?
And COVID-19, we were facing with a virus that was perfectly adapted to man from the start. In fact, it didn't even like that much to go into bats. I defended the outbreak hypothesis initially. naturally occurring. Absolutely. This common things occur commonly. We have other diseases going on. This is the century of emerging infectious diseases. We'll have more. So I supported this whole Handley and poo-pooed the idea that, number one, the Chinese have a very effective biological warfare program. And I couldn't believe that we would actually be assisting this. Well, we were, or certain members in the government were. Dr. Anthony Fauci, yes. And not just that, but we were giving them technology such as teaching them how to put human receptors in mice, because you don't want to use monkeys and non-human primates. And mice are very cheap and very easy to find new drugs and test vaccines and blah, blah, blah. If they have the human receptor, you can make mice susceptible to COVID. This is called gain-of-function experiments. And you can do it very simply just by serial passage of a virus through a particular animal and make it change species. Or you can do it genetically very quickly by actually cloning the receptor and putting it into the germ cells of the mice, and their babies have the human receptor. And that technology was passed over to the Chinese through University of North Carolina.
So we did, in fact, help the Chinese biological warfare program become more efficient, major, more capable.
You can do it with other receptors as well. It was a major advance for them.
Yeah.
We funded.
And one of the places where they were working on this was the Wuhan Institute of Virology.
Yeah.
Okay. So you were initially persuaded that this was a naturally occurring phenomenon. At what point did you become persuaded that it was something else?
This furin cleavage site, which is a genetic segment of the virus, we couldn't find an evolutionary thing where it would have, it just suddenly appeared. That was number one. That's suspicious, but there are some coronaviruses with this type of thing, so we'll give it that. And then there was a section called the Staphylococcal enterotoxin B motif upstream from the furin cleavage site. And Staphylococcal enterotoxin B is a biological warfare agent. This was the active site. Now, the amino acids were different, but if you three-dimensionally modeled this area, you got a 3D configuration that was identical to the toxin in Staphylococcus. The ones that caused the toxic shock syndrome back in the late 70s with the long-duration tampons. Those things were taken off the market immediately, but it's horrible. I mean, it is a super antigen. It turns on your whole immune system. You've heard the name cytokine storm. It turns on like 30% of every lymphocyte in your body at the same time. And you die from toxic shock. What is that thing doing in the middle of an animal virus? There's no way. And the fact that the amino acids were different, and the fact that if you grow the COVID-19 virus on anything other than human cells, it tends to throw this segment out. These are signs of manipulation and that it was forced in there.
Purposeful biological warfare engineering, which is a conclusion that you helped us reach in this book by Team B3. Dr. Hatfield was really the scientific expert that we drew upon. And just to bring this point home, as the evidence continued to accumulate that this thing was incubated, genetically modified, developed, however you want to describe it, in the biological warfare program of China. The issue as to whether it was deliberately unleashed from the laboratory or whether it somehow got out and thereby became, you know, a threat to the population of the surrounding area immediately and then far beyond, was something that you pointed to as decisively evidence of a purposeful biological attack by the Chinese Communist Party.
Let's put it this way, Frank. This original Wuhan strain was highly infectious. If you were handling it in the spacesuit laboratory, by design, and human adapted. If you were handling it in the spacesuit laboratories, the BSL-4 level, that's fine. But they were playing with this thing at much lower biosafety. There's evidence from archived blood samples taken in France and from certain things that were going on in China at the time that this broke out in 2019. And it had time to change and become better adapted to man and even better adapted to. They were having problems well before New Year's Eve of 2019. Blood samples in France were turning positive in September of 2019. There's big traffic between China and France because of the garment trade. You may buy
The French. The French also constructed this laboratory for
Italy.
Them as well.
Not France, but Italy.
Okay.
So you can buy an Italian soup, but it's made in China. And Italy, the provinces, and it looks like it really was. You could see it would have been the Wuhan strain. Jeffrey Bloom went on to the internet. The Chinese deleted a bunch of DNA sequences of coronaviruses before they announced the outbreak.
But one of our key findings, Dr. Hatfield, in this book, The CCP is at War with America, was that however it got out of the laboratory, once it was out, once they were having the kinds of problems that you've just mentioned, they did something quite purposeful and deliberate, did they not?
You lock Wuhan down, but you allow all the citizens there, and they can't go to any other Chinese city, but you're giving money to the older people so they can go have Christmas and Chinese New Year with their children in America and all over the world. How can you lock your city down and facilitate international air travel?
So this gave rise to our conclusion that it was indeed a biological, deliberate biological warfare attack, which brings us back, and we're going to have to take a pause here just another moment, sir, but it brings us back to what you were confronting in the White House as Tony Fauci was insisting that there were going to be these remedies, whether it was remdesivir or whether it was going to be these gene therapy developed vaccines. And so just to catch us up with the storyline, Peter Navarro had lots of ivermectin. It was beginning to get out. Donald Trump endorsed it. Then what happened?
Hydroxychloroquine.
Hydroxychloroquine, correct.
We were surging the drug out to the pharmaceutical companies from the strategic national stockpile. Doctors were writing scripts. They loved it. It was working. You started to see a slight little plateau, I think, in New York City. And then they started to intentionally shut it down. The deep state.
This is the subject to which we're going to turn when we come back from this short break. Who were these deep state operatives? What was their motive for preventing a cheap, effective, widely available drug from saving people's lives? And are they going to be held accountable for having done that? These are the questions that we're going to probe with our eminent friend and colleague, Dr. Stephen Hatfield, on the other side of this break. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. There's been a lot of talk lately about the big lie, the totalitarian practice of repeating an untruth until it inevitably becomes accepted by the masses as true. One monstrously big lie at the moment is Democratic partisans' insistence there's no evidence that Joe Biden has engaged in bribery and other crimes for which the constitutional remedy is impeachment. With House of Representatives Republicans yesterday unanimously agreeing to initiate a formal inquiry, the question is not whether the evidence is sufficient to warrant what amounts to an indictment by the House. Rather, it is whether treason, will be among the charges. The available evidence shows that Biden has received directly and indirectly tens of millions of dollars from the Chinese Communist Party, and virtually every one of his policies has harmed our country and benefited the CCP. Let the prosecution begin. This is Frank Afton. We're back. Dr. Stephen Hatfield is in the house virtually with us. And Doctor, this plot is now thickening. You have people who clearly knew better, Dr. Tony Fauci being the most publicly visible of them, not revealing what they knew about the Wuhan Institute of Virology and the work being done there with our money and technology and help. The Chinese exporting this disease purposely as a biological takedown of this country and others. The plot develops further insofar as we wound up being told that this so-called mRNA vaccine made by different manufacturers was safe, effective, and had to be taken, mandatory jabs, the like. And this returns us to the theme of your article in the Journal of the Association, American Association of Physicians and Surgeons. Pick up the storyline at that point, sir, and the implications of it.
Well, the hydroxychloroquine was working. And what we suddenly started to see was a rash. What we needed was an investigational new drug authority, because our friends overseas had given us a lot of this hydroxychloroquine. They didn't want it sold on the market and people making profit from it. So it was put in the national stockpile, and to use it, it needed an investigational new drug authority. Janet Woodcock at the FDA was told, you know, let's get this done. Rick Bright, who was in charge of the Strategic National Stockpile, a PhD scientist and a vaccinologist, he's not a doctor, was told, okay, let's get an IND and we'll search this out.
Now, why was a new drug, you know, investigation necessary? It was an old drug.
Used for a different purpose.
So you actually have to have that off-label application investigated.
Yeah, just an extra application. Because the people that donated it didn't want it being sold for rheumatoid arthritis and everything else, and other people making a profit. They gave us a lot of money's worth of drug or precursors. And we bought some, and anyway. So Janet Woodcock had phoned Rick Bright and told him, oh, this is a dangerous drug. Well, she's a rheumatologist by initial training, internal medicine. She knew it was a sick. Millions of people have had it. You can, nursing mothers can take it. Pregnant women can take it. We don't let pregnant women take any drug. And Rick Bright decided he would take it a step further. And he got a hold of the media and said that President Trump was trying to foster a dangerous drug on the United States. So the emergency use authorization came out, and it specifically stated for use in hospital only. Well, by the time you're hospitalized, you're in the second phase of COVID-19, and it's life-threatening. You're short of breath. All sorts of different changes are happening in your body, none of them good. The trick, if you take hydroxychloroquine within the first 7 days of symptoms, you don't go to the hospital.
Right.
So,
if you have to go to the hospital to get it, it's too late.
Plus, you control the pandemic. You can't control a pandemic with an in-hospital treatment. They've already infected everybody. What you do, you catch them early when the viral production is still low. You put them on hydroxychloroquine. You send them home for about 5 days. Don't go to work. Don't kiss your kids. Don't kiss your wife. Don't kiss your girlfriend, anybody. And you can bring it under control. 52 other countries did that and kept their pandemic under reasonable control.
Yep.
We didn't.
We didn't. And in the war between docs, you're going to talk about some of this, obviously, war between doctors. Just to cut to the chase, because we're going to run out of time before we run out of things to talk with you about. Two bureaucrats in the deep state, as you've called it, made a decision that essentially was in the vital interest of those big pharma manufacturers, yeah, which is to have no other available drugs, which gave rise to an emergency use authorization for their mRNA,
yes,
experimental drugs. Is that basically where this thing went next?
Where this thing went. Nobody.
So we got unsafe, untested, or inadequately tested drugs instead of the tested ones, yeah, on the basis of their say-so? I mean, it's unbelievable. Yeah.
Well, there's an outside panel, but then the outside panel has people like the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine that refused to publish a breakthrough hydroxychloroquine paper in July of 2020, with the Ford group showing 51% reduced mortality if you give hydroxychloroquine as the patient comes into the emergency room. You don't wait for testing. You give it to them immediately based on doctor's suspicion. You get a 51% improved survival. This was repeated by Mount Sinai, and it was repeated by a large overseas study in Spain, which showed a 61% improved survival. We now know it's an 81% improved survival if you add zinc and some other.
Yeah. So even if it, you didn't get it till you got to the hospital, if you got it right away in the hospital, your prospects improved greatly.
You knew that by the end of 2020.
Yeah. And again, how could this possibly have come to pass? Was there nobody overseeing it all? Or in fact, were we being encouraged to do precisely this by the World Health Organization, for example, who had its advisory role, to be sure, but was nonetheless promoting pretty much this, sounds a lot like the China model to me.
It was the China model. It's not a lot like, it is. Whenever you bring in a coordinator to a White House task force, that's indicative that nobody on that task force knows what they're doing. And the same thing happened during the Ebola debacle. At that time, we probably spent $100 billion on biological defense since over 25 years. And you couldn't handle 11 Ebola patients on U.S. soil without complete drama. Mm.
Dr. Hatfield, hold the thought. We're going to come back to where the drama took us next, and in particular, what is now being proposed, rather stealthily, I have to say, to give the WHO, the World Health Organization, even more power over our public health policy. Stay tuned for that. Be right back. We're back for this final installment of a very important conversation with one of our country's leading experts on pandemics and what to do about them, born of some very hard experience, I have to say, including most recently as the guy at the White House who was trying to implement the pandemic plan and found it kind of shot out from under him by some folks at the National Security Council and kind of rewrote it in the middle of the stream, as they say. So, Dr. Hatfield, just to bring this to a particularly relevant point as we speak, We're talking about new pandemics in the offing. The Chinese are masking up again. It seems curiously timed for, another election in this country. I'm sure that's purely coincidental. But whatever it is, the bigger problem, as I see it, is as this is playing out, this May, the current plan, again, being stealthily advanced aggressively by the Biden administration, and by the way, by Big Pharma, and by the way, by Bill Gates, and the World Economic Forum, and the European Union, and not least, of course, the Chinese Communist Party, is set to create new powers for this World Health Organization, not just to advise us, but to dictate to us when we have a public health emergency of international concern and what we must do about it, all at the say-so of a guy who's not even a medical doctor by the name of Tedros Ghebreyesus, the director general of the WHO. What's wrong with all of that picture?
Well, the WHO has changed dramatically over the years. Number one, it's not part of the United Nations. It's associated with the United Nations. Okay? It's become very political. The agencies that you just mentioned supply funding in addition to the member donor states that supply medicine, U.S. being one of them. Quite frankly, it's become nothing more than a political collection of individuals with little expertise in pandemic management. They have no power.
But a lot of special interests, notably in manufacturing these so-called vaccines. And,
they do some interesting things, like in developed countries, public health, this type of thing. But for the most part, they have no resources. You can buy them. How's that? You can purchase them. And you can rent them. Quite frankly, we pulled out of the WHO, I believe, temporarily, and we should pull it. Well, he was correct. We need to leave that and start a new organization. It's too political now. It's not your best and brightest there. There are some bright people, make no mistake, and there's some dedicated people, and it was a bloody good idea to have something like that, especially we're now in the century of pandemics. But it's become something twisted and money dependent, and it's lost its original mission.
And but if it were in fact able to not just advise with all of those shortcomings, that even seems dubious, and based on the experience with the pandemic just recently concluded, having them have essentially, in the person of Tedros especially, dictatorial powers that would actually, crush our sovereignty and public health,
utter
sovereignty specifically.
The fact that this is even raising its head indicates that this is yet another institution that needs to be dissolved and replaced with something fresh.
Amen.
The
argument that they're doing this is to create new global governance arrangements.
Yeah. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I don't know of any other way to look at this.
Yeah. Well, it's what they claim. I mean, it's really not evidence of a conspiracy theory. It's a conspiracy.
It's a grab for power by bureaucrats that are funded by outside sources that aren't under any sort of control.
Yeah. There's a very important hearing this week, Wednesday, in the subcommittee of the House Oversight Committee that is charged with, among other things, trying to learn the lessons of this pandemic. Dr. Brad Wenstrup, a member of Congress from Ohio, is the chairman of it, and a good man, I think. I'm prayerful that they will. The title of the hearing is Reforming the WHO. I think you're absolutely right, Dr. Hatfield, that we need to get out of it. If you were testifying, and I wish you were, what would you be telling the committee about what's afoot here and what we should be doing about it.
Well, the WHO is no longer a World Health Organization. It's been wrong in virtually most of the pandemic decisions that have been made. It followed the lockdown principle, for which inhibits herd immunity, and it was it's just made mistakes completely along the way.
Yeah, the China model, it specifically, was, as you say, which didn't work out so well for the Chinese, did it?
No, it didn't, did it?
Yeah. So, Steve, and thank you for, you know, walking us through this rather torturous path, and I must say you've helped me get it straightened out a bit. To the extent that we find ourselves at this point facing new pandemics, you say this is the century of pandemics, especially if mankind is helping engineer them. It's likely that we will. Just in 40 seconds, sir, what is the most important takeaway for what we should be doing next?
We have to centralize our surveillance system. Data mining has proven to be an excellent source of new outbreaks. We need verification teams. Early drug treatment is the preferred method to control these outbreaks. We don't have enough antiviral drugs that are effective. We have 20,000 pharmaceutical compounds that have never been tested for off-label antiviral activity. There needs to be a crash program at once to initiate this. We just found that the common water tablet, the common diuretic spironolactone, completely blocks the Epstein-Barr virus.
Well, Dr. Hatfield, we could go on. We can't because we're out of time. Thank you. I'm concerned about that big data being in the hands of the Chinese Communist Party myself, but we have ways of working around that, I'm sure. Thank you for your leadership. Come back to us with more in the near future. And congratulations on this new article in the Association of Physicians and Scientists publication. God bless you, my friend.
Thank you very much.
I hope the rest of you will join us next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.